I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. On the 150th anniversary of the end of the Civil War, the battle is still on to tell the story of America's defining tragedy. History is written by the victors, Winston Churchill said, but not our Civil War, which so many eyewitnesses said was beyond all words in its horror, in its scale. More Americans died in battle on home ground between 1861 and 1865 than in all other American wars put together. From the Revolution to the World Wars to Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, and Afghanistan. Just as hard to absorb is the core issue, the almost unspeakable reality of slavery in our foundations. And then there is something deeper than irony in what followed the Civil War. Reconciliation between sections, North and South, alienation and separation between races, black and white. There was a peace among the whites, as Frederick Douglass had dreaded, that reinforced the subordination of the blacks. This is the first of several open source reflections on the Civil War at a milestone in an epic that never ends. We'll begin with the defining historian of race and reunion, David Blight at Yale, and we'll bring it home with the historian Kendra Field at Tufts. She is mining her grandparents' rich record of the dilemmas facing freed slaves in the South 150 years ago this week. First, though, who cares about the Civil War today? Thousands of reenactors care enough to relive the battles in the field and in their heads. Here's a sample we reached out to this week, articulate white guys with a variety of lessons learned.
We do the 28th Massachusetts Company H.
I am with the 28th Massachusetts Irish 4th Regiment Union Army.
Currently reenact with the 1st 11th North Carolina State Troops out of Eastern North Carolina.
My unit is the 1st North Carolina Volunteers, 11th North Carolina Troops. We also have a federal alter ego of the 151st Pennsylvania Volunteers or the School Teachers Regiment. Why were they fighting? I wish I could go back and ask them in person. I would imagine that a lot of them felt they were defending their state, not necessarily any institution of slavery, but I think just to defend it from what they perceived as foreign invaders.
The government of the South expressly fought to keep slavery. And the issue that we have is that people whose ancestors fought for that aren't comfortable acknowledging that while their great-great-great-grandparents were certainly brave enough to fight for a cause they believed in, they can't acknowledge the fact that the government that those men fought for was a government based on human bondage.
People should know that not every soldier on the Confederate side was a slaveholder. Most people in the Confederate Army were just poor farmers and had no slaves. They were not wealthy plantation owners. When the people would feel that a contract is broken between the government and the people themselves, the people need at some point to be able to stand up against the government and at least fight for what they think is right versus wrong.
But a lot of these guys fought for this country to keep it together, to be the democracy that it became. No matter what you may think of wars or the political ramifications of it, people sacrifice so that we today can have the freedoms that we have. And don't ever forget that.
We seek to honor those men and women, but I think they would probably tell us today we're crazy as hell to reenact this stuff. We should go home and enjoy our families. But we keep their memory alive and what both sides fought and sacrificed for, and that hopefully newer generations can perhaps learn from the mistakes that were made by the older generations.
Those were Blues and Grays this week, Union and Confederate reenactors, North and South. David Blight at Yale, we're deep into your books, Race and Reunion and American Oracle, that explain the frames in our heads about the Civil War and how they got there. And this week, we love your big essay in The Atlantic Online, The Civil War Isn't Over. Remind us, how has this story changed in 150 years, and where is it today? What would it take to get it straight?
Well, thank you, Chris. And I have to say, I really enjoyed those voices of those reenactors.
You found
about every kind of perspective there is out there among reenactors. How has Civil War memory changed? Well, in vast ways. In the 50-year period after the war, the first half century, down to 1913, 1915. The generations that fought the war fought like the Dickens over its memory. They struggled over the memory among veterans. They struggled over the memory in politics. They struggled over the memory in culture. But by about the 50th anniversary, there was a vast culture of reconciliation. It can also be called a culture of reunion, and some people think those two ideas are different. But what happened in that culture of reconciliation, culture of reunion eventually, exhibited by the early 20th century at occasional blue-gray reunions, is a reunion that happened at the expense of some of the deepest issues and some of the most profound consequences that the war brought about, namely the initial rights given to African Americans after they were liberated. I mean, it's no mystery, it's no news to people that by the turn of the 20th century, a segregation system, a vast Jim Crow structure in law and social practice and even in the minds of people, had set in across the former Confederacy, in fact, across all of the South. And that Jim Crow system, that American apartheid, was in part created on or forged out of this struggle over the memory of the Civil War.
So that reconciliation view is really up against the emancipationist view of the war.
Yeah, there were actually three or four different varieties of Civil War memory, if you want to use categories. But one is, of course, what I called the emancipationist vision. This was the idea that the principal great result of the war was the emancipation of 4 million slaves, out of which came the three great Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th, the 14th, and the 15th Amendments, the recrafting of the Constitution itself. This was kept alive, for sure, in abolitionist memory, neo-abolitionist memory, and in particular in African-American communities. But it was up against this increasing sense of the necessity of reunion and the necessity of reconciliation, the building of a new country. It had to come. You see, the country faced an almost impossible conundrum or dilemma, and that is, how do you heal a society, a culture, a polity, after that kind of bloodletting? That's pretty much the biggest war fought in modern history to that day. How do you heal after that? At the same time, you try to establish whole new regimes of justice. And at the heart of all of this was the fact that the cause that lost, the side that lost, the South, what eventually we call the culture of the lost cause, the cause that lost initially did lose just about everything except its fundamental beliefs in white supremacy. And out of that structure of white supremacy, beliefs in white supremacy, the Southern states will take back control of their politics by the end of Reconstruction and take back control of their culture in the latter third of the 19th century. And the North will, over time, acquiesce in simply allowing the South to control its own regimes of race relations.
David, I want you to sort of unpack that lost cause. I mean, it's Southern nobility, Southern gentleman. It always reminds me of Southern comfort or something.
yeah, it's a lot more than whiskey, though. It's a lot more than whiskey. The lost cause essentially is an explanation of defeat. It is forged very, very early after the war. In fact, in some ways, it begins right there at Appomattox. It begins right there in Robert E. Lee's farewell address to his troops. What Lee says to his troops is that you were not defeated on the battlefield. You were overwhelmed by, quote, superior numbers and resources. Not defeated on the battlefield, defeated by a kind of leviathan of industrialization, a leviathan of numbers. And then eventually this becomes a set of arguments. It actually becomes a set of beliefs in search of a history and in search of a cause. And the lost cause culture eventually is arguing that the South didn't fight for slavery, that it only fought for its homes, that it only fought for its self-defense, that it only fought for state sovereignty, and that they were a truly noble cause that nevertheless lost, but it only lost against this kind of superior numbers and industrial civilization.
But it's a story sanitized of a lot of evil. Everybody's a hero in a certain way. Everybody's a fighting peasant. But the question in my mind is, how did the North buy into it?
Well, it doesn't buy into it early on by any means. There's a tremendous spirit in the North in the wake of the war that we might call a kind of Union victory memory. It was especially true among Union veterans. It took a long time for Union veterans and even Confederate veterans even more so to go to any of these blue-gray reunions. But eventually you got to understand that Reconstruction was considered in the North a Southern problem, and it became an extremely difficult set of issues and problems to sustain Northern interest in it. I mean, for example, by as early as the Depression of 1873, it was a major economic depression that set in 1873, and the Southern states all succeed in what they called redeeming their politics, Southern Redemption, as it was called, by 1876 and 77. Well, that's happening at a time of tremendous unemployment, tremendous economic hardship, and Northerners are, in effect, kind of sick of the Southern problems, sick of the dilemmas brought on by the war, caused by the war. They wanted it to be over. They wanted the issues to be over.
But the important thing here is, though, that it's a process that squeezes race and liberation almost out of the story. We're talking about the Civil War in memory with David Blight to begin. Among the questions, why do so few black people study the Civil War, or do they? That was Ta-Nehisi Coates' question originally. Kendra Field at Tufts University has an answer. She's a young scholar of the war and of emancipation, starting with the story in her own family. This is Open Source on the Civil War.
Hurrah for the choice of our nation, our heroes so brave and so true. We'll go for the great Reformation, for Lincoln and liberty too. We'll go for the boy from Kentucky, the hero of Hoosierdom through. The pride of the suckers so lucky, for Lincoln and liberty.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. Checking our memory on the Civil War story at the sesquicentennial. 150 years this week since the South surrendered at Appomattox and the killing stopped. David Blight at Yale is telling us how the storyline was written and rewritten. For Kendra Field at Tufts in our studio, it starts with family. For all of us, the stories we choose to accept become the actions we're willing to take. In the Civil War centennial season, 50 years ago, James Baldwin, the black novelist and prophet of The Fire Next Time, put it this way, as a problem.
For 100 years, the American Republic in general has ignored and denied the whole situation that Negroes have operated within. To be a source of cheap labor, for example, North or South, is to be, in effect, oppressed. Now, the oppression is bad enough, but the myth that the country is created about the object of the oppression, the myth about the Negro being happy in his place, is something the Republic has managed to believe. And so that in addition to the fact of oppression, one has also the fact that within the country for 100 years there's been a way of life occurring in the country which most of the country knows nothing about. One's got to remember, after all, this may sound very rude, but you got to remember who wrote the history books and toward what end. I have never known a lethargic Negro. I've known a great many demoralized Negroes, but that is not the same thing. The truth is the Negroes have been fighting for this 100 years to obtain their rights, but and the country has ignored it. And the technique of the country has mainly been to accommodate it or to contain it, but never really to change the situation.
That was the late James Baldwin at a forum in Florida in 1963. Our guest, Kendra Field, is writing today about freedom's first generation, the children of emancipation in the 1860s. Welcome, Kendra Field. The Ta-Nehisi Coates version is that for black people, the Civil War sounds too much like a sports event, and the history of it sounds like baseball cards. Not for you, I take it.
Yeah, no, not for me. I think that, and I think not for him either, not for many many individuals, past and present. You know, I think there's different entry points into this era, and all of them are kind of part of the larger tapestry here. And I guess I would say that, you know, I think about the Civil War myself through the lens, as you said, of freedom's first generation, this generation of men and women who were born enslaved, children at the time of emancipation, and together experienced that rise and fall that David was talking about of Reconstruction in the rural South. In my case, I'm writing about my grandmother's grandparents and others like them whose lives straddled both slavery and freedom and survived what historians often call the transition from slavery to freedom. And I got the beginnings of this story from my grandmother, and over time from other relatives who passed down the stories they had learned.
Her great aunt was there at the time.
Right. So my grandmother's grandparents were part of this generation, born just before and during the Civil War.
I'm with her saying, you know, wondering, what now? Where do we go?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I mean, I would say that in relationship to Civil War memory, I mean, myself, you know, I remember I had these stories coming from my family within the household at the kitchen table. And then, you know, I had high school history trips to Civil War battlefields, and the distance was vast. You know, I don't remember, my kind of lasting memory was that this wasn't my family history per se, right? And, you know, even now as a historian who understands deeply the powerful role that African Americans played in the coming and in the outcome of that war, I don't spend that much time myself on battlefields. So I make the choice in my writing and in my teaching to turn instead to kind of home places, grave sites, kinship networks, where people kind of lived the material realities of that transition from slavery to freedom.
But imagine what grandma's great aunt is dealing with at the moment of emancipation. Where do we go now? What's changed? What's really changed? What hasn't changed? What's never going to change? And the fall in expectation too.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I think this was a period of high, of kind of rising expectations, incredibly high hopes, and then deep disappointments, the kind of violent reversals of the end of Reconstruction that came so quickly on the heels of such a spectacular moment. I mean, this generation, my grandmother's grandparents witnessed the election of over 1,500 black office holders at the local, state, and federal level, including a senator from their neighboring county, a U.S. senator. And then they quickly, by the late 1890s, had witnessed the removal of all of those elected officials from office.
Sounds like an Obama moment.
Yeah. I mean, I think it is quite striking to think about the high hopes of Obama in combination, in concert with the kind of racial violence that we witness.
Hmm. Who's doing the racial violence, and how explicitly and how widespread? I mean, how did we feel that?
The violence of the war continues into political violence in the late 1860s and into the 1870s, but it takes a turn after the federal government fully retreats, as David was talking about, and white Northerners turn a blind eye towards the growing violence in the South with the return to Southern, quote-unquote, home rule.
Where does a black family in, say, Mississippi look for alternatives? What are the other possibilities? What did they see?
Yeah. So this generation, by the late 1870s, in fact, has begun migrating quite some distance, both to Kansas, to Arkansas, to Indian Territory, Oklahoma, north and west, beyond the U.S. You have a resurgence of an enormous scale of Back to Africa movement, of black emigration within and beyond the U.S.
Sort of. A preview, in a certain way, of the 20th century migrations.
Yeah.
But with what
yeah.
differences? I mean, and how did it work out?
Work
Starting
out.
With well. Your family. I mean, where did the fields go?
Well, in the case of my family, they migrated first to Mound Bayou, which was an all-black town in Mississippi, in the Mississippi Delta.
Right.
So they migrated a bit west. And then about 1900... In the early years of the first decade of the 20th century, they migrate to Indian Territory right before Oklahoma statehood. And there you have about 50 black towns and settlements that emerge between about 1880 and 1905.
David Blaine, I wonder, you know, what's new here? What's still to be found? There's a story, even in what Kendra's just outlined, that that I haven't heard. Civil War history is a kind of a white guy's business, too. But what are you learning?
It's not a white guy's history anymore.
Forgive me.
Yeah, no, it really isn't. It isn't your granddaddy's Civil War anymore. Well, it isn't in scholarship and hasn't been for a long time. And it isn't your granddaddy's Civil War anymore, even in a lot of schooling and curriculum, at least in parts of this country. What's new to be found is thousands and thousands and thousands of more family stories like the one Kendra is just telling us about. Hundreds of thousands of black families searching actually for members of their family and during Reconstruction, and then searching for some place to go. And one of the hardest things Americans have to process in this memory, there are many things, many difficult elements of this memory. It's the most divisive experience in all of our history. But one of those things is the violence of Reconstruction. It is the one time in our history when terror and torture and murder became part of a kind of normal politics. We don't have perfect numbers about this, but something in excess of 3,000 people were killed in political violence just during the Reconstruction years. That's a very hard thing to, as Baldwin was saying, that's a very hard thing to incorporate into some kind of triumphal or pleasing narrative of your history. You have to stop and face it and realize that there is as much venality and tragedy in our history as there is in anyone else's. So there are many elements of this that just don't process into the kind of master narrative of progress that we still like to think of when we think of American history.
I'd ask you both, this is a season of emancipation, a century or a time in the 19th century of emancipation. Russia, the Tsar, in my ignorance, was the one who freed the serfs in Russia. We're the only country where the process becomes a matter of a deeply grave war. How so?
Well, I actually love that question. I like confronting my students with it. Of the 20-some nations and empires that freed slaves in a century, from the late 18th to the late 19th century, and it's an amazing story if you think about it. In one century, humankind, legally at least, ended many systems of slavery when these systems had existed for millennia. But why only in the United States did it end in all-out civil war? Now, there was plenty of violence in other places, in the British Empire and in Russia for sure. But it happened in part because we were a republic. It's a way of thinking about it. The Confederacy, that is the South, the side that owned all the slaves, the interest in slaves, they were free to dissent. And they were a very powerful political force. And we don't always like to think about it this way, but the Confederacy, thank God it was a failed dissent, but it was the greatest dissent in American history. It was a huge dissent in the interest of establishing a white supremacist slaveholding republic. And if we stop to, you know, have a solemn commemoration of Appomattox, if we stop now and then finally to have solemn commemorations of emancipation, we need to remember that Union victory didn't just mean, you know, Union victory. It meant that the Confederacy did not win, and that slaveholders' republic, had it won some version of its independence, had it won some version of its conception of victory, we'd have an entirely different history. We'd live in a very different society. And you almost have to try to imagine you'd be living in a country that didn't even have the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments.
Kendra, I'm wondering, what were your ancestors, what were African Americans after the war making of this lost cause yarn? I mean, we hear the bitterness in James Baldwin's voice about the myth of the happy Negro, but what do you make of it?
Well, you know, I mean, I guess it's worth saying at this point that there were all sorts of ways that African Americans were attempting to commemorate emancipation in those early days after,
right.
You know, afterwards.
All over the place.
you know, the black press later would refer to them as veterans of the late war, over 200,000 black men who had served in the Army and the Navy. As early as 1866, free people beginning to celebrate Juneteenth in Texas and then spreading through to other states to the present. But, you know, I agree with David that it's really important to kind of mark the violent end of Reconstruction and just to really sit with the scale of that violence and the ways in which the narrative that emerges kind of authorizes the continuation and the expansion of that violence into the 20th century in the form of Jim Crow. You know, the question that I ask is kind of. And, you know, the question that Frederick Douglass would have asked, for instance, is what is the meaning of these kinds of celebrations? What is the meaning of commemorating emancipation in the context of that level or that kind of betrayal? So Douglass in 1886 gave a speech that was intended to be on the occasion of the 24th anniversary of emancipation. But the title that he gave it was, of course, Southern Barbarism.
Right.
So it's Southern Barbarism, speech on the occasion of the 24th anniversary of emancipation, really kind of highlighting the paradox of that moment. And in that speech, he details the explosion of racial violence in the South, particularly an event that happened in Carrollton County, in the town of Carrollton, the Carrollton Massacre, which is just at the other side of the county from where my own family was living at this time, in which 100 armed white Mississippians on horseback moved on the Carrollton Courthouse, opened fire on a group of unarmed African Americans who, Douglass wrote, had shown their respect for the law by going to the courthouse, right? They went to attend a trial. And I think, like thousands of others at this time, thousands of former slaves, they were killed for attempting to participate in the democratic process, right? Mm-hmm. This was the first true kind of experiment in multiracial democracy that we have. And as short as it was, as brief as it was, it's enormously important to kind of acknowledge the ambition and the aspiration of that moment. And here were this group of 15 or so African Americans, former slaves, all of them who are sitting in the courthouse to observe the trial. And they're killed for appearing to be citizens, right, for appearing to be free. And I think, you know, by calling attention to that in the context of a ostensibly commemorative speech about emancipation, Douglass is really carrying forward a hugely important tradition of using these sorts of occasions about the past to engage in a conversation about the politics and violence of the present. And I think that's part of a critical part of the black intellectual tradition, the black prophetic tradition that Du Bois, you know, and others carry forward into the 20th.
Hey, Chris.
Please, David.
Well, Kendra makes such a good point. Douglass was, of course, brilliant at doing that and using memory. But one of the things that happens, especially after Reconstruction, once the lost cause reaches its 20th and 30th birthday, if you like, by the turn of the 20th century, the lost cause is no longer really a narrative about loss at all. It's a victory narrative. It's a victory story that the South is telling to the whole nation, and the victory they're talking about is the victory over Reconstruction.
Yeah.
The lost cause narrative becomes a victory narrative over the process of Reconstruction. Mm-hmm. And it gets into the formal histories, and it gets into scholarship, and it gets into schooling way into the 20th century.
Yeah,
go ahead, Kendra.
Oh, I just thought this is, you know, incredible, you know, ending of Du Bois's Black Reconstruction, the 1935, where he says, you know, that 3/4 of the testimony against African Americans during this period was on the evidence, the unsupported evidence of men who regarded it as loyalty to blood, patriotism to country, and filial tribute to their fathers to lie, steal, and kill in order to discredit African Americans. And that, I mean, speaks to the kind of thoroughgoing native, how this really made it into the mainstream narrative of this moment.
David Blaine, there's a vast story sort of at stake here. Your man Robert Ben Warren, the novelist of All the King's Men, makes the Civil War, I mean Child of Tennessee, but makes the Civil War sort of the motherlode of every American issue, and certainly of all these things we're talking about, citizenship, justifications for violence, the social contract, what government does, can do, can't do. I mean, remind us of the ways. What's at stake?
Well, you mentioned Warren, and thank you for doing so. He wrote one of the most important pieces ever on Civil War memory at the Centennial in 1961, a little pamphlet book called The Legacy of the Civil War. It's still very, very much worth reading. Warren, of course, grew up at his Confederate grandfather's knee, learning all these stories, and lived his life essentially trying to overcome the lost cause. And in so many ways he did, as a Southerner, as a white Southerner, as a genius artist, novelist, writer, essayist, poet. But it was Warren's view, and this is something I think we Americans need a bigger dose of. It was Warren's view that the Civil War was an authentic tragedy. I mean, a tragedy on a Greek scale, a tragedy that was the product of terrible forces at work in Americans that they could not control. And that, I mean, Warren was really trying to puncture every balloon as best he could in this American demand for triumphalism, in this American demand for progress. He still had a toe or two now and then in the old lost cause, because he always wanted to honor his grandfather.
Hold it there, David Blight, if you will. When we come back, we'll talk about that tragedy and that sense of tragedy and just what's missing in the Civil War version that's embedded in our common culture, in our brains, in our Hollywood. This is Open Source.
Oh, I am a good old rebel, now that's just what I am. And for this Yankee nation, I do not give a damn. I'm glad I fought again, I only wish we'd won. I ain't asked any pardon for anything I've done. I hate the Yankee nation and everything they do. I hate the Declaration of Independence, too. I hate the glorious Union, 'tis dripping with our blood.
I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're sorting out Civil War stories that are still unfolding against a background of movies and mythology, fiction and fancy. Check Leslie Howard and Clark Gable here playing Ashley Wilkes and Rhett Butler in Gone with the Wind, the movie. They're talking in a crowd pre-war about the South's stakes in the battle.
What does the captain of our troops say?
Well, gentlemen, if Georgia fights, I go with her. But like my father, I hope that the Yankees will let us leave the Union in peace.
But Ashley!
But Ashley, they've insulted us.
You can't mean you don't want war.
Most of the miseries of the world were caused by wars. And when the wars were over, no one ever knew what they were about.
Why, Ashley, if it wasn't about...
No, gentlemen. Mr. Butler's been up north, I hear. Don't you agree with us, Mr. Butler?
I think it's hard winning a war with words, gentlemen.
What do you mean, sir?
I mean, Mr. Hamilton, there's not a cannon factory in the whole South.
What difference does that make, sir, to a gentleman?
I'm afraid it's going to make a great deal of difference to a great many gentlemen, sir.
Are you hinting, Mr. Butler, that the Yankees can lick us?
No, I'm not hinting. I'm saying very plainly that the Yankees are better equipped than we. They've got factories, shipyards, coal mines, and a fleet to bottle up our harbors and starve us to death. All we've got is cotton and slaves and arrogance.
That's right.
Our guests are the historians David Blight at Yale and Kendra Field at Tufts. They've been telling us how this story has been spun. David Blight, in your Atlantic piece, just out, you suggest that the lost cause idea is alive and well in American politics this year and next, and you'd have to strain not to see it in the police shooting in Charleston, South Carolina, just a few days ago. Another shard of institutional white supremacy hasn't gone away. You write, the great issues of the war, the Civil War, were not resolved at Appomattox. In this sense, not only is the Civil War not over, it can still be lost. What are you talking about?
Well, thank you, Chris. I do believe the war, of course, ended in 1865. The shooting war ended. But the great issues of that war, which were faced during Reconstruction, let's remember. The first Civil Rights Act was passed, the Reconstruction Acts, the three great constitutional amendments, this incredible experiment in racial democracy that lasted in some places for 5 years, in some places for 10, in some places a bit longer. But the two great strands, to boil it down, the two great strands of legacies from that war and from Reconstruction are one, of course, in race and in the question of rights and in our race relations. Every time we think we're finally getting over our race problem in America or we're becoming something called post-racial, we get shocked to realize, no, we're not. And then the second great strand is, of course, federalism. The relationship of the states to the federal government. And we are now living through, and it's been going on for actually 3 decades, we are living through a huge, new, modern, late 20th, early 21st century revival of states' rights, especially at the state level, especially in state legislatures, but also, of course, in our Congress. All you got to do is look at the front page of the newspaper any day. About any number of issues, resistance to Obamacare, resistance to the Environmental Protection Agency, resistance to any kind of new federal immigration law, resistance to the Interstate Commerce Clause, resistance to taxation. The tax revolt in this country is in some ways a states' rights revolt. Now, what I mean by that phrase, that the issues of the Civil War are not really over and the war could still be lost, it's the struggle over these issues that still could be lost. Let's look just at one simple thing. The 15th Amendment began the right to vote for black people, for black males only at that point. That got revolutionized, of course, in the 20th century and after tremendous blood and sacrifice. In the 64 Civil Rights Act, and especially the Great Voting Rights Act of 1965, recently celebrated in the film Selma. But what did the Supreme Court just do a couple of years ago but strike the central clause out of the Voting Rights Act, which gave federal authority control over those states that had practiced Jim Crow and disfranchisement for so many decades? In the absence of that, what happened? Immediately. Many state legislatures controlled by the Republican Party, let's be honest about it, as fast as they could, passed voter ID laws, which they claim is all for the protection of the integrity of the ballot. But any of us with one eye open know they're doing it to suppress the votes of black, brown, young, and older people who don't vote Republican.
This will sound like a detail, David, but I learned it from you, too, that birthright citizenship is
Section 1 of the 14th Amendment was a gift of
Reconstruction, and it's at risk today.
The Section 1 of the 14th Amendment is the umbrella under which we all live. It's birthright citizenship, and it's equal protection before the law. That's where that language got into the Constitution. In the spring of 1866, it passed Congress. It was finally ratified a year later. Section 1 of the 14th Amendment is the new Constitution. The Constitution, in terms of human rights and our liberty before law, was not written in Philadelphia in 1787. It was really written in Washington in 1866. And to be quite frank about it, Section 1 of the 14th Amendment was written by John Bingham, an evangelical Christian Republican abolitionist from Ohio. That's the Constitution we live under. But the more and more and more that we erode the meaning of that 14th Amendment for basic rights, the more and more we run some risk of losing what that Civil War was fought over.
Kendra Field, I'm wondering what you're feeling about the sort of recycling of these issues in the present day.
Yeah, I mean, one thing I would say is, you know, I think it's kind of commonplace to kind of casually you know, in kind of our popular culture, to think about problems like these as being rooted in slavery, right? But I think, to kind of David's point here, it's actually, for me, a lot more productive to think about them as being rooted in freedom, right? Or the kind of impossibility of black freedom in that post-emancipation and certainly post-Reconstruction moment. So, for instance, some of the kind of continuities of the antebellum period carried into the post-emancipation period, to be sure, in terms of the control and kind of immobilization of a black labor force of 4 million people, right? But what was new was the kind of criminalization of blackness itself, which we see, of course, the kind of varieties of and continuation of today. And I think it does something important for us to think about what was it about freedom, about black freedom, right? That that sets this path in motion, right? The disappearance of categories of slave and free, right, from the perspective of white Southerners, the kind of upending of their of the society, political, and economic system, right? And then the imposition of increasingly rigid categories of black and white, and particularly a marriage of kind of blackness and criminality that gets produced and fabricated and perpetuated in dominant culture and in governance and legislation and throughout and into the 20th century.
And why is it happening?
Well, you know, there's all sorts of I mean, for me, I turn to kind of land and labor, right? So this enormous question and concern on behalf of former white slave owners, white planters of the post-emancipation period is continuing to produce or regaining the profits of cotton, of tobacco, of sugar, right, in the rural South. So this is really a continuation of the economic story of slavery and capitalism into the post-emancipation period, and the kind of desperation that they might lose this labor force either to self-employment, to people who want to simply grow food for their families to eat as opposed to participating in cash crops, or to migration. I mean, every time you see one of these out-migrations to Kansas, to Arkansas, to Indian Territory, you see this incredible fear and desperation in the writings and in the newspapers of the white planter class, right? They're fearful of losing this labor force, right? And so there's all these ways that people get caught up in the kind of emerging convict lease labor system. Douglas Blackman has written a book called "Slavery by Another Name" to this effect, right? The ways
marvelous
in which
book.
People get kind of immobilized and kind of kept in place in the name of criminalization, right?
Right. That's a marvelous book you mentioned, and I'm struggling for the name of the author.
Douglas Blackman.
Douglas Blackman, indeed. And he wrote about the criminalization of blackness in Jim Crow, mm-hmm. to the point that standing on a corner for more than 10 minutes amounted to a kind of vagrancy for which a man could be grabbed, without trial, of course, but end up in a brick factory or a dangerous, dirty job, mm-hmm. And never get out of it.
Right.
David Blight, do you want to comment on that cycle?
I think it's useful to point out here that history that Kendra has just laid out, that on the ground economic history and this criminalization of blackness, is a history Americans by and large still don't really know. They do know the great epic of the Civil War, and that's nothing wrong with that. I mean, the Civil War, but this is the problem. The Civil War, if you think about it, the war itself is a great epic. We love that epic of the war, this contest between the two sides, this bloodletting for, you know, reasons that were fundamental. And in the end, you know, the right side wins and somehow we get stronger for it. It is a great epic if you think about it. 80-some years into the history of the only fledgling republic on earth, it tears itself to pieces. It fights an all-out war. It destroys slavery, and it has to put itself back together. That's one hell of a story. But what we don't like, and we do not face enough, are all of those nightmarish consequences that flowed from it. Our problem with Civil War memory is our problem of remembering Reconstruction and its aftermath. We love that epic. We just don't like its nightmarish responsibilities and consequences that flowed from it. And here, if I might, just there's a wonderful line by Baldwin. I wrote a long chapter on him in that book, American Oracle. And Baldwin had this line where he said, "The problem with the way Americans use words about history is they use words to cover up the sleeper but never wake him up."
Kendra.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean, I think from the perspective of going back to African American memory, the war was less of a discrete political event, right, as it might have been from other perspectives, right, and more of a kind of turning point in the material realities of people's lives, right, in land and labor and kinship networks. And so I think it's really critical to think about what it meant to be on the ground to be coming of age suddenly legally free with little to no material resources to make freedom real, right? And in that sense, right, we see the problem of kind of an all too neat narrative of slavery versus freedom, right? And I think it's important to kind of put aside the ideas and particularly the ideals to follow instead the kind of stuff, right, the land and labor and the people themselves.
Can I go back to David on this matter? You speak of epic, but you were also speaking of Greek tragedy. And it seems to me the larger assignment is to get our heads around this story as tragedy. And your man, Robert Penn Warren, again, spoke eloquently on this point. He said the word tragedy is often used loosely. Here we use it at its deepest significance, the image in action of the deepest questions of man's fate and man's attitude toward his fate. For the Civil War is massively that, he said. A story of a crime of monstrous inhumanity into which almost innocently men stumble, and then a climax drenched with blood, but with nobility gleaming ironically. I mean, how do we master that mind? Ralph Ellison spoke of the same thing, to get our heads around it in a different way, David Blight.
Well, those two guys could use language, couldn't they? What Warren is after there is this idea that authentic tragedy comes from deep within our nature, deep within our condition, deep within our flaws. And what he's really trying to say is that America had some terrible, deep problems and flaws that it had not faced. It did not even know how to face. And it stumbled, crawled, fell, collapsed, and directed itself into this collision that became this bloodletting beyond what anybody had ever conceived of. The problem is that the word tragedy itself gets in the way. Americans don't like the word tragedy.
We like our tragedies with happy endings.
Exactly. William Dean Howells said that beautifully in 1900. We love a tragedy as long as we can give it a happy ending. But if you talk to Russians about tragedy, or Germans, or people in many other cultures, they don't expect their tragedies to have happy endings. But in American culture, for a host of interesting reasons that are at our roots and in our religion, in our civil religion, we think history should always be heading towards some kind of redemption. And that is one definition of tragedy. It's supposed to be that suffering from which we learn, that suffering from which we grow. And the Civil War is that kind of an event, too. We obviously have grown from it and did learn from it, whatever we want to talk about. But the problem is that Americans just don't like that term, tragedy. We don't even quite frankly know how to use it.
Ralph Ellison had some thought, and this is for you, Kendra Field, that Negroes, as he described them, have a different tuning for tragedy. I mean, can you help us with that?
Well, you know, I want to talk about Ellison, but the quote that I was thinking of from Ellison is where he talks about our unknown history, right? Which I think gets at, if not tragedy, certainly kind of the trauma of this moment, right? And the silences that kind of carry forward from that. He says, our unknown history doesn't stop having consequences, even though we ignore them. And, you know, in the case of the Civil War, I think for African-American communities, remembering the Civil War was remembering slavery, right? Itself, including aspects of war and trauma. Forced separation of children and parents, experiences of torture, right? And I think that for many urgent reasons in the decades after the war, many former slaves and their children were committed to distancing themselves from slavery, right? From the stigma of slavery, both literally and figuratively. So when I talked earlier about that kind of wave of migrations that begins in the 1870s and doesn't stop, right? In the midst of expanding racial and sexual violence, right? You have freed people attempting to distance themselves from the very space and time of slavery, right? And they frequently did this through migration.
But here's the way Ralph Ellison put it in his words. And I read this in David Blight's book, but he said, he hungered for a tragic understanding of the Civil War. He said the last true note of tragedy was sounded and quickly muffled in our land when the North buried Lincoln and the South buried Lee, and between them cast the better part, both of our tragic sense, except perhaps the Negroes, and the capacity for tragic heroism, into the grave. Where is it now? That's for you, Kendra. Big question with the time running out.
You know, I think that there are millions of these stories. There's also millions of silences, right, within these stories, between stories. And what I'm eager to hear more of is young people interested in engaging in the stories that we still do have access to before they disappear.
Thank you, Kendra Field. Thank you, David Blight. Check Professor Blight's new take on the big question of Civil War memory at theatlantic.com. Thanks also to Jerry Burke and Megan Kate Nelson for guiding us around Civil War Boston. We'll be continuing a series next week with a show on Reconstruction with the historian Eric Foner. So check our website, radioopensource.org, to remember our Civil War sesquicentennial. We're going out on John Brown's body as performed by Lenny Baldwin's Dauphin Street 6. Our show is produced by Union soldiers Pat Tomino, Connor Gillies, and Max Larkin, with help from the Carolina Rebel Grant Hullab Mormon. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our field commander. I'm Christopher Lydon.